to real political negotiations over ceasefire in the current conflict via first really small steps. That means, why can Russia and Ukraine not find a forum, an internationally mediated forum, where they would talk about exactly humanitarian protection zones, about disengagement around the atomic power plant in Zaporizhia, about small potential ceasefires for the beginning of school, for the harvest, for the sowing of the fields. This would bring about these exact same advantages, namely humanitarian advantages, and every life saved is a big step in the right direction. Secondly, the ground could be prepared to establish some kind of little small trust, which has been completely lost by now by the sides. And thirdly, such a forum where the sides would meet and be in a position to interact on a permanent basis with neutral mediation, but with other countries such as the West as observers, would probably also have a de-escalatory effect. This would probably likely have the effect of preventing escalation that may otherwise take place. So this is what we can maybe take from the failed Minsk negotiations forward into some kind of segue into negotiations, how they could start now.
So, Wolfgang Spohrer, take that a step further. Where do you see these kind of mini or pre-negotiations taking place? And what countries do you see mediating that negotiation? I mean, today you have the image of Lavrov and Blinken shaking hands. But at the same time, you have the U.S. increasing tension with China sending over $600 million in weapons to Taiwan. You have Putin and Xi Jinping's alliance. Where do you see this happening?
The location is, I think, of secondary importance. By now, I can see Istanbul. Let us not forget that Istanbul is the place where right now Russian and Ukrainian officials are sitting together on a daily basis, negotiating in the context of the Black Sea European Grain Initiative. So Istanbul as a location would be, I think, a good one. More important is the question, who could play the role of a mediator? I hear on many occasions that people think about personalities like Brazilian President Lula. We just heard in your news that potentially Indian Prime Minister Modi. I'm a little bit skeptical of this, as I would not be surprised if either Ukraine or Russia actually would reject these countries as a mediator, because they do not actually, they would probably not assign that amount of impartiality to these countries. It is my guess at the moment. However, I think organizations such as the United Nations or the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation, would be ideally suited, because they are kind of neutral by definition. That means the UN or the OSCE could basically give a coat, could give the role or a coat of mediator to an eminent personality that enjoys the trust by both Russia and Ukraine, and such personalities still do exist. So the setting would be, this would be under the auspices of the United Nations or the OSCE, taking place in Istanbul or in a comparable city, with the Ukraine and Russia as the main participants, but, which is important, particularly for the de-escalatory function of this facility, with the West, the United States, the European Union, China, India, and Turkey as observers of this process. They are to facilitate when they can. They are to work with their allies when they can and when needed. Now, the question is, why should the sides to the conflict at this point in time be ready to engage in something like this? Let me just underline, participating in such negotiations does not cost the sides anything. It does not mean a change in the position in the field. It does not mean giving up any type of political or military position that you have held so far. So these would be negotiations that could be entered into at zero cost for the sides, but with potentially great benefit. But therefore, they should also be entered into with no preconditions. And I think it would be the duty of the West on the one side and of China and China and India on the other side to convince both Russia and Ukraine to inform them constructively that a participation in such negotiations would be deemed as highly welcome.
Professor Zubok, if you could respond to what our guest Wolfgang said, and also talk another article that you wrote in The Spectator last year, just days after the invasion, headlined The Post-Soviet Roots of the War in Ukraine, in which you talk about the significance of the Crimea, Khrushchev in 1954, handing over Crimea to Ukraine, the Soviet Republic, and the fact that you've said that Crimea is the principal or one of the principal obstacles to Russia and Ukraine speaking at the moment.
Well, you raised two very important points, and I read with great interest what Dr. Sporer wrote, Wolfgang Sporer wrote about the importance of talks, and I'm all in favor of this idea for a sort of a dry run of talks of the future. You know, we have plenty of experience during the Cold War when, for instance, talks on POW or MIAs were taking place during the Korean War between the sides. And they, you know, the war still lasted in a stalemate for a couple of years, if not more. And then suddenly Stalin died and a new political and Eisenhower was elected and a new political situation emerged. And the same kind of, you know, dry run talks, almost, you know, futile talks suddenly became a vehicle for signing an armistice. So the very existence of this venue, or I would say practice, where the sides are accustomed to meet and talk, is really, really important to prepare for the future. I would be very skeptical about involving multilateral organizations or organizations like OSCE for one simple reason. In the Russian eyes, you know, most of members of the OSCE are members of NATO. And also Turkey, of course, is very important, but Turkey is also a member of NATO, although an unusual one. So, you know, what's important, I think, not only credibility and impartiality, but also power. So, you know, previous negotiations that led to some kind of solutions, I'm not saying that those solutions were, you know, good or bad, just solutions to military conflicts, like, you know, the end of the Korean War I mentioned, the end of the first Indochina War, the Geneva Accords, even the Paris talks that ended the second Indochina War between the United States and North Vietnam. They involved several parties, but not multilateral organizations. So for me, you know, I don't have that experience that, you know, Wolfgang Sporer has, obviously. I'm a historian. But for me, the ideal combination would be Ukraine and the U.S. on one side and Russia and China on the other. On Crimea, of course, we have it as a bone of contention between the two sides. But let me say, it became much worse now, much worse, because from the Russian perspective, if Putin loses Crimea, that would mean the end of his claim on whatever heritage of Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, and all the rest of them, the Russian imperial glory, and huge humiliation. You know, even the blow up of the bridge, if it happens the second time, will be a huge blow to him. And exactly for this For this reason, the Ukrainians realize this is his Achilles heel. Not Ukraine for Ukraine, the Crimea is no longer only a beachhead from which Russia could deliver another attack, you know, strategic menace to Ukraine, pointing to its underbelly in the south. But it's also an opportunity, as Khrushchev used to say about his partners, to grab Putin by the balls. I'm sorry for the expression. And if they manage to ease the Russian forces out of Sevastopol, the glory of the Russian Navy, and destroy the Black Sea Navy, that would be an intolerable humiliation for Putin, which in Ukrainian perspective would kill all the birds they want to kill, not only remove the Russian troops from the Ukrainian territory, but to topple the autocratic regime of Putin.
We want to thank you both for being with us. There's so much to discuss here, and we will continue to do so. Professor Vladislav Zubak, professor of international history at the London School of Economics, speaking to us from London, and Wolfgang Spohrer, the conflict manager and adjunct professor at the Hertie School in Berlin, Germany. We'll link to all of your pieces at democracynow.org. Next up, we go to Tel Aviv and Huwara in the occupied West Bank. On Sunday, hundreds of Israeli settlers attacked the village in what's been described as a pogrom, all while the Israeli army looked on. Israel's new finance minister has called for Huwara to be wiped out. Stay with us. By the Palestinian artist Julwood. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. A top Israeli official has called for the Palestinian village of Huwara to be wiped out or erased, just days after hundreds of Israeli settlers attacked the city, setting cars and homes on fire and killing a Palestinian man who had just returned from Turkey, where he was helping with relief efforts after the earthquakes. Israel's far-right finance minister, Smotrich, made these shocking comments on Wednesday.
The Palestinian village Huwara should be wiped out. The state needs to do it, not private citizens.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh visited Huwara Wednesday to meet with families who survived the violent attack.
What we've seen here in this house is evidence of how big the crime carried out by the settlers and covered and protected by the army is. It is clear that this move is supported by a political decision from the Israeli government. Therefore, three sides are partners in this crime: the government, which takes the political decision, the army, who is protecting, and the settlers, who are implementing. This is what we saw here.
The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem accused Benjamin Netanyahu's government of backing a pogrom in Huwara. In a statement, the group said, quote, the Jewish supremacist regime carried out a pogrom in the villages around Nablus yesterday. This isn't loss of control. This is exactly what Israeli control looks like. The settlers carry out the attack. The military secures it. The politicians back it. It's a synergy. On Wednesday, Israeli Army Commander of the West Bank, Major General Yehuda Fuchs, admitted what happened in Huwara was a pogrom.
The incident in Hawara was a pogrom carried out by outlaws. We were prepared, as we prepare for every terror attack. There's a phenomenon of outlaws taking to intersections to throw stones and block Palestinian roads in the area. I don't think that collective punishment helps to combat terrorism. On the contrary, I think it might even cause terrorism.
The settler attack in Hawara began hours after a Palestinian gunman shot dead two Israeli brothers from a nearby settlement. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government is continuing to face mass protests from Israelis opposed to plans to overhaul Israel's legal system. On Wednesday, Israeli police fired stun grenades and water cannons at Israeli protesters taking part in a so-called day of disruption, as thousands protested in Tel Aviv. We're joined now by two guests. Gideon Levy is with us. He's an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist with the newspaper Haaretz, member of its editorial board. His latest piece is headlined, Israeli Settlers' Hawara Pogrom was a preview of Sabra and Shatila 2. Gideon Levy is also the author of the book, The Punishment of Gaza. And Saddam Omar is with us, a resident of Hawara who witnessed the attacks by Israeli settlers. Let us begin there. Saddam, can you talk about what happened on Sunday? Where were you in Hawara? And describe where Hawara is in the occupied West Bank.
First of all, good morning to you and to everybody. I want just to let me remind you and everyone that this tragedy started not on Sunday. This started for more than 106 years, 1917, and our suffering is going on since that time. Actually, Israel, as you know, occupied West Bank, Palestine, and Gaza Strip since 1967, and since that time, they violated international law by moving hundreds of thousands of Jewish-only squatters, colonists, into the Palestinian-occupied land. In response, Palestinians have been resisting the occupiers. For Hawara and what happened on Sunday night, it was not the first time, and it was not only for killing of two Israelis in Hawara. What happened really was a few days before, when Israeli army did a massacre in Nablus. They killed 11 people, including two old men in their late 70s and few children. This terrorism led by the Israeli army is a continuous action since 1967 and before that time. The campaign that happened in Hawara on Sunday night was protected, planned, organized by the Israeli army. Those squatters held, protected, organized the settlers to do what they did. The army prevented any citizen to defend himself. And you saw what happened with Samih al-Aqtash, a 37-year-old man who recently came back from Turkey, helping people there after the catastrophe of the earthquake. A few days later, those squatters, barbarian settlers, attacked him. He was trying to defend his wife, mother, sisters, children. But they prevented him, and killed him with cold blood. The army now is 100% controlled by Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, who are already settlers. This massacre this accident happened in Hawara, supposed to making the settlers to take control of the whole West Bank. The Israel occupation army is complicit in a drastic surge in terrorism committed by Israeli colonists against Palestinian civilians. The recent terrorist attack against the residents of Hawara was pre-planned, pre-prepared by the occupation army and the settler militias. We all heard what Smotrich said. Hawara must be wiped out. It's not a new thing. The previous militias of those settlers already wiped out more than 500 villages and towns of Palestine when they occupied the lands of 48 and 67. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were evicted from their houses and homes to the West Bank, Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and worldwide. The extreme government of Israel is a threat to Palestinians, to Israelis themselves, to the region, and to the whole world. This is what I believe.
Gideon Levy, could you talk about what happened in Hawara and also the massive increase in settler violence since this far-right government came into power?
You shouldn't start with this violent government, because the last year with the so-called moderate government was not any better. There were almost 200 Palestinians killed in this year, more than in any other year in the last 15 years. So we couldn't put all the blame on this government. I came to Hawara on the morning after. Hawara was practically under a curfew. And what I saw there, I saw very few times in 35 years of covering the occupation. It really looked like a town after a pogrom. There's no other way to describe it. Quite horrified people and shocked people sitting in their homes, afraid to get out. All the shops closed, and only traffic of, you won't believe it, Amy, the only traffic that was allowed was obviously the settlers who came back to see what they've done the night before and what they didn't complete. They did it in a very brutal way, as they always do. Don't forget there were 400 settlers in Hawara the night before, according to the army, which means they might have been even more. And nobody stopped them. And this is maybe the core issue. The fact that nobody stopped a raid of 400 settlers on an innocent village tells you the whole story.
Saddam, could you describe now what the situation is in Hawara today? You said that immediately after the massacre, a curfew was imposed. What's the situation now?
It's a total closure. And shops, supermarkets are totally closed. Nobody is allowed to open his shop or supermarket or whatever it is. If you tried to open your shop, you will be arrested immediately. Yesterday, a citizen called Omar had been arrested for trying to open his shop, and he's violently treated. According to what we witnessed, the occupation army did not take measures to block the settlers' path to Hawara, nor did it stop them from systematically attacking Palestinians and their properties. nor did it carry out appropriate arrests. They claim they have arrests, but till now we saw nothing. The occupation army sought to let the settlers vent their anger. Following the settlers' terrorist campaign, the occupation government of Israel didn't take any significant actions to address the settlers' lawlessness. Instead, some occupation officials, just like Smotrich, publicly supported the settlers by saying words like Hawara should be wiped out. The Israeli settlers took advantage of the situation by inflicting millions of dollars of damage onto the town of Hawara by destroying, burning anything inside. There was no specific target of their attacks. Rather, it was whatever happened to cross into their line of sight. I mean, trees, cars, spare parts shops, homes, livestock, market stalls, shops, supermarkets. Whatever they saw, they destroyed. They were being guarded by the Israeli army, who trailed behind them a few meters as protection. Hundreds of residents were injured from the barbaric methods they utilized. They lit homes on fire while the residents were still inside. They used tear gas. They stole stones. They used iron rods.
I want to ask...
And they were... Yes, please.
I wanted to bring Gideon Levy back into this because we're seeing massive protests in the streets of Tel Aviv of Israelis now hit with stun grenades and water cannons. But they're not protesting what's happening in Hawara. They're protesting the Israeli Benjamin Netanyahu's attempt to gut the Israeli judiciary. Are these protests morphing into protests of what has happened in Hawara, or are they just two completely different issues for Israelis?
They are not two completely issues at all, because both deal with democracy. The problem is that the protest movement in Israel wants to keep an eye closed and not to see the occupation as part of the problem of the Israeli democratic regime or non-democratic regime. This is really outrageous, because it's not that they don't deal with Hawara. They do anything possible to break away from dealing with Hawara, with the occupation, with all those issues which are part and parcel of Israel's regime. And therefore, this protest, which I cannot participate by all means, is a protest over democracy for the Jews in the state of Israel, nothing but this. And anyone who really looks for equality and democracy cannot participate in this protest, as impressive as it is, as powerful as it is. But we have to remember, they are concerned only about themselves, only about democratic regime for the Jews in Israel, not for anyone else who lives between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean.
Saddam, very quickly, we have just a minute. What do you think the international community should be doing? How can the Palestinians be supported now, given this massive onslaught of violence?
I want to add something that it was a barbaric sight that you can only describe by an ethnic cleansing. It's very sure that this is the proper description for what happened. But for the international community, we need them to interfere and to bring peace and stability to the Middle East, not the United States. You know, the United States of America is a party to the conflict. United States of America is a part of this conflict. It's not a referee. USA is not the judge, is not the proper judge for this conflict.
Saddam, we have 5 seconds.
The United States of America, yes. United States of America is providing the occupiers with full support. They have to stop, and the international community should interfere to protect the civilian.
Saddam Omar and Gideon Levy, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Studio 6, CGSS video series, captures high-quality video recordings of live performances.
So, who are you?
Is it that question?
We're necking.
It's a necking question.
We're a band?
And Jenny Blues with impactful and inspiring artists.
We weren't very good at keeping it a secret.
As well as engaging conversations with community members about the issues that are most important to their communities. Watch all of the Studio 6 live sessions on CJSF's YouTube page or on our website at cjsf.ca/studio6.